webcasting to the world.
Do you remember the moment that you saw yourself in God and God in you, and you were one with the universe and God and everybody?
Knowing the truth about the gospel.
You were one with the prostitutes and pimps and priests and kings, and there was nobody on earth that was better than you nor less than you.
That we are all righteous.
And no one on earth was any less in Christ than anyone else.
That's Mike Williams, and this is the Gospel Revolution.
Welcome to the Gospel Revolution Powercast for the 29th of August, 2013. Coming to you from right here at the GR Studios in Nashville, Tennessee. And from Houston, Texas, please welcome from the Gospel Revolution headquarters, our founder and president, Michael Williams.
Good evening, Aussie Ferris Bartlett. How are you today?
What makes you say I'm Aussie tonight?
I mean, well, you come on wearing this hat. I mean, you know, it's not good enough that you sound like the Geico Gecko. You have to come on wearing a hat.
Geico Gecko? Now, let me guess. You sound Canadian to me, right?
I sound Canadian to you?
Well, if I sound English to you, you must sound Canadian to me. Hey.
Hey. Yeah. Yes, and good evening again. And I've talked to a couple of people this week, Ferris, and they are, a couple of comments I got was, you guys aren't fooling us. We know when you record this. It's like, boy, it took you that long to catch on. You were really slow. So we've got some gospel revolutionaries out there that aren't too fast. So we have to take things slow sometimes.
Well, as President Nixon said, you can fuel some of the people some of the time, and you can fuel... No, what was it? You can fuel some of the people all the time. You can fuel all the people some of the time, but you can't fuel. Was that President Nixon? I think it was.
Fuel? What are you talking about? You're leading me down a primrose path here. I can already feel it.
Yeah, he was talking. Remember when the gas prices went up? And he said... So, stick around where we say Christianity. Believe what I say, or I'll hurt you. Hey, Mike, have you had an interesting week?
It has been an interesting week. One of the most delightful parts of that week is one of our board of trustees arrived here this week. Michael is on the board with Mike Williams Ministries and friend for, oh my gosh, 20 years or more. Michael was in a church in Minnesota, very charismatic church. When I began to speak on grace, I eventually was invited not to come back to that church.
That's an unusual thing for you, really, isn't it?
That was a very unusual thing to happen to me during that time. But Michael eventually came to work with me out on the road, and we're going to be talking about that a little bit, and I want Michael to tell you his experience himself. But the person who challenged me, confronted me, insulted me with the redemption of the world is this man right here with me right now and staying in my home this weekend, Michael Planch.
In an earlier broadcast, you mentioned two questions. And one of them was, I think, your friend Chris, and the other one was from this gentleman, Michael. Is that right?
That's correct. Chris, it was the issue of sin. Does sin exist at all? And the other one is the whole world redeemed. And those are the two questions that I dared not ask. They were becoming obvious to other people. I honestly was not headed that direction myself. There was nothing in me. I know that people look over this and they kind of feel that I was building up to this and saving this understanding that sin doesn't exist and that the world had been redeemed and that I was plotting this out. Believe me, I was only sharing what I knew. And I was pretty much of the mindset that my contemporaries at the time knew, is that if I ever broached the subject that there was no such thing as sin and that the whole world was redeemed, I was out of a job. And honestly, if you mess with the money in Christianity, you've taken the banana away from the monkey. But what I was teaching was so progressive, if you will. It was so, my goodness, people were coming to life. The meetings that I was speaking in were exploding to the point where the capacity for the parking lots and the buildings were just not to be contained.
Sounds like you were really packing them in.
Well, this was because I was sharing the difference between grace and law. I had been completely of the word of faith persuasion. I learned the gospel of peace, and then I began to share on the difference between law and grace. And nobody was talking about grace during those days. I went to the bookstore to find a book on grace. And this was a fairly large bookstore there in Southern Illinois. And I just wanted to know what grace was, what other people had to say. And there weren't any books. There were shelves and shelves on faith and obedience. And goodness, you could absolutely name your subject. I know that there were books written on grace before that. But that was not what the bookstores were carrying because nobody was looking for the books. And when I started looking for the books, there were not any. But speaking on this subject of grace ignited people's hearts. It was really quite amazing what happened.
Why is that? What did it turn people on?
Well, I can tell you about my experience when I taught it at Rhema Bible Training Institute in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And at that meeting, there were three of Kenneth Copeland's board of directors. The president of his board, the president of Kenneth Hagin's board was there. When I finished teaching, I'd done a couple of sessions on grace, and I went back to the green room, which is the room where everyone stays before the service, after the service, and everybody waits on you and caters to your every need and, you know, might have a meal back there or something. And I remember one of the, in fact, it was the wife of the Canadian board of directors for Kenneth Copeland Ministries. She had lifted her hands and was doing laps around the green room, crying, saying, I knew there had to be something. There was something that was missing. I knew there was something that was missing. I knew there was something was missing. Something was missing. And she was in tears. And we got that response a lot from the Word of Faith community. Watching these people, it was like seeing a group of people sitting in chairs submerged underwater, a foot over their heads. And as I would teach them, it was like raising the floor to where that suddenly they went and taking a breath of air. It really was that drastic. And many people expressed it that way themselves, that it was like being submerged in water and not having breathed in so long. And then finally having a breath of air. In Norval Hayes meeting up in Gatlinburg, when I taught on the difference between law and grace, Norval was terrified that I was going to preach on grace. And his daughter had arranged for me to come in, hoping for some reconciliation.
She had a bit of a soft spot for you, didn't she?
Yeah, you know, we were the same age, and we were kind of brother and sister, you know?
Is that what you thought? I mean, you were good looking at the
yes.
time.
Yes. Well, I have no concept at all that it was anything other than brother and sister.
Yeah, really, okay.
You have to talk to somebody else about that.
Oh, no. This conversation's done me quite enough, thanks, sir. I think I got the picture.
So I was upstairs, and I was so torn because I was supposed to do the next morning session, and Norval had told me, Mike, now speak on deliverance. Now, I'd never disobeyed Norval. I prided myself in obeying those that had authority over me. I still have a very good place in my heart for Norval. I mean, his impact in my life was amazing. It moved me from point B to point D, maybe, but, you know, it was part of my process.
Well,
and
here's the truth. It doesn't matter who they are in our past, they were still part of our journey.
Absolutely.
And our journey above everything else is valid. Maybe some of the stations were not terminuses. Maybe some of the engines pulling us were not the one that would take us to our destination. But our journey is always valid, no?
Yeah, and that's what I look at. And even as Michael and I were talking this weekend, I still have fond memories about the Word of Faith days. There were really good things that happened along the way. It doesn't give credence to the doctrines we learned. It doesn't give validity to the things that we did. But it still had things that we had a tremendous fondness about in the memories. You know, I mean, who can remember being in the motor coach with Manuel driving, who was fresh out of prison and tried to run a sports car off the side of the road by taking our motorhome off the edge of...
I got to hear that story.
And then I was in there with my wife and brand new baby girl, and Manuel was determined that these two racing cars were not going to pass him on either side of the motorhome, and one tried to pass in the right in the right emergency lane. So Manuel simply drove into the emergency lane. What was it in the Bandit? Smokey and the Bandit car.
Yeah.
It's one of those cars. And so he just decided he was going to drop off into the dirt off to the right and pass us anyway. And Manuel decided, no, you're not. So we dropped off not only of the emergency lane, but down into the grass sloping off to the right. And you're in a big motorhome and it tilts like that. Oh my gosh. So when that was all over with and we arrived at wherever we were going and I got safely out of the van with my wife and my daughter, I told the people we were in under their authority in this excursion with Norval that me and my family would never ride in the motorhome with Manuel again. And we were rebuked. And they said, who are you trusting in, God or Manuel?
Oh, come on.
Hazel would be able to tell you. Now, people don't believe me. Everybody believes Hazel. Nobody believes me.
Have you ever sat yourself down and asked yourself why?
No, I don't want to know. But to continue this story, I did not have this understanding and was withholding it from people. People were getting this understanding that all were redeemed just simply because of the conclusions of what I was teaching. And people were coming up to me and saying, well, Mike, we've come to the conclusion that, you know, we've gone beyond you. And it's like, I was insulted. It was like, you know, what do you mean you've gone beyond me? Well, from what you've taught us, we can't see anything except that the whole world is redeemed. And we know that you don't believe that, so we're not coming back. People stopped listening to me because I didn't teach the redemption of the world before the other way around started happening. Because the teaching of law and grace just has its own understanding incorporated. I was not fudging on law and grace. I was not going to compromise. And when I was in that hotel room that night, knowing that I had to go the next morning and preach on deliverance, I remember I did my little Bible roulette thing, and I was in anguish. And Michael was there, in fact. So a whole lot of the history of the gospel revolution is sitting right here in this room or right now. I was up. I couldn't go to sleep. I'm sure I was disturbing Michael. And I remembered having my night light on over my bed. And I opened my Bible and I thought, what am I going to do? Norval wants me to teach on deliverance. I felt I was supposed to teach on freedom from the law. And I literally opened my Bible and I looked down at the verse in front of me and it said, for Christ hath delivered us from the law. And I about came out of my skin. I could not believe what was happening. And I decided I get to obey Norval and I get to obey Jesus. I'm going to speak on deliverance. So that morning I got up and everybody cheered. And I was always a favored speaker in those groups. It seemed I sold more tapes than Norval and Brother Hagin put together. So I got up and I said, okay, repeat after me. And I said, this morning, Brother Mike is going to teach on deliverance. He's going to teach on deliverance. Yay. They were all stoked because this was a deliverance ministry. You know, we taught people how to cast out devils and stay free. And in that meeting, I taught on how Christ has delivered us from the law. And one particular gentleman that had been in every meeting for the last probably 10 years, where his wife pushed him in and kept him up front and had to suction saliva to keep him from strangling to death.
Well, he was in the wrong meeting. He should have been in the Benny Hinn meeting.
Well, Norval claimed to be able to do at least as good, if not better, than Benny.
Oh,
and
okay.
So I made the statement that if anybody tells you that there is something you've not done that is keeping God from healing you, they have lied to you.
Oh, boy. Beginning of the end?
Oh, yeah. But the reaction from the people was profound. There was four or five cases in that crowd. It was not a big crowd because Norval was teaching people a prosperity breakfast at the same time I was doing my meeting. And people used to ask me, what is a prosperity?
I want to know that. Is that like, do you get triple pancakes? Do you get extra bacon?
What is a prosperity breakfast?
I want to hear this too. Is it four eggs instead of two?
And I had the audacity to say, well, that's a breakfast you go to that makes Norval prosperous.
Oh, boy. Yeah, you're right.
But that was near the end. I knew the end was near anyway, so. But they all got a big kick out of it because they kind of understood the concept here. But of the group that was there that morning, there was a handful of cases where they just literally collapsed in tears into the shoulders and the laps of the people next to them, weight of legalism coming off of them.
Because they believed that suddenly it wasn't their sin that was keeping them sick.
Absolutely.
Wow.
And it was not their obedience that was causing the devil to have access and God not to have access, and this horrible weight come off of them. After the meetings, you know, Michael and I would talk about the meetings. He was a obsessive note taker. He's sitting across the table here from me right now doing the same thing he did 20 years ago. Michael and I were talking after one of the meetings, and he had his notes out, and he began to question me about what I had just said. Now, if this is this and that is that, then that means, and he's very hesitant, I think, because he realized that he was treading on some very thin ice as far as this whole thing was concerned with me and with the whole Christian world.
He was treading on thin ice with you.
Oh, yes. You got to understand, I was trained to expect the respect I gave. I've always been a nice guy, but religion always takes the worst parts of you and puts it on display. So Michael asked me, doesn't that mean that everyone is righteous? I remember the question very clearly. And my abrupt answer was no. I don't know that I allowed him to finish the sentence.
Did you do like you did with Chris? Did you say, don't ever ask me again?
That didn't happen with Chris. When Chris made that comment, I just knew it was true.
This was Michael you said that to?
This was Michael that I said that to.
Okay. And he's still your friend?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. But that wasn't the last time that Michael brought this up. I eventually forbade him to bring up the subject again. And then he dared do it again. And it was not a pleasant moment. We were driving west in the van and headed to a meeting. And I saw Michael fidgeting in his seat, and I knew what was coming, and I was deliberately ignoring him. I wasn't going to say, what are you doing? What's up? I wasn't going to ask a question because I knew that he would take that as an invitation to ask again. I didn't want to hear it. And he just barely broached the subject, and I just went off. And I told him, I said, I told you not to ever bring that up again. And here you are doing it. And the terrible thing about all of this is that, of course, there was this silence that fell on the rest of the trip. And the moment we got there, the pastor approached me and told me that he'd gotten a call that Michael's father had just passed away.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, it was tough. So here I was, if my self-righteousness would not let me feel bad about how I responded to Michael, boy, this made me feel bad about how I responded to Michael.
Yeah, and how.
So now I really felt like a heel. And then I had to tell Michael about his dad, and he got on a flight to go be with his family and was gone a couple of weeks or so, and then came back. But this really was challenging to me, and I had to think my way through it. And I can't really tell you at what point that I conceded that this had to be the truth. I don't remember that point. I just remember this torture. It was torture. I was tortured inside with the reality of my own teaching, leading people to the conclusion that everyone on earth had been made righteous. Now, after that happened, I did go through several meetings. I don't know how many months I went through withholding that information after I did become aware of it. The teaching didn't build to that point with the redemption of the world in my back pocket waiting to bring it out. The understanding of the redemption of the world was pressed upon me based on what I was teaching.
Now, Mike, when you say this was a crucial moment in your evolution, I just heard you say that you weren't ready to preach about the redemption of the world, but while you were still thinking about it. And yet, if there was any term that we use to describe the gospel of grace and peace, it would be redemption of the world, right? So
yes.
I'm kind of taking from this that this was one of the biggest watershed moments of your life.
Oh, it definitely was. I mean, others could be measured based on reference and point in time, but this one certainly was the moment in the progression of this understanding of the gospel of peace and the gospel of grace. What does that mean? And the conclusions of grace and peace is redemption of the world. There is no other conclusion to grace and peace except that. It's not that it wasn't acceptable to me to be true. It was just inconceivable to me.
Why?
that would be true. I was a Christian. I didn't know anybody Christian that believed everybody was going to heaven. My doctrines may have varied from one group to the other, but I was thoroughly Christian.
There is something innate in all of us that seems to know this is alien to what appears to be natural to me.
Yeah.
And if I was to latch onto this alien thing, I'll lose everything else that is natural to me.
Yes. our center of gravity seems that it's going to be gone if this point moves.
How long did this period of time, between when Michael's statement woke up something in you, how long between that time and when you finally said, oh, what the heck, I'm going to come out?
I would say it was no more than about 6 months or so, but you've got to realize I was speaking all the time at the time. So it's not like now where I do maybe 4 or 5 meetings a year. I was doing 4 or 5 meetings a month.
So every time you had one of these meetings, every single week, in other words, you're speaking every week.
I was confronted with this in my own mind. So I would say probably about 6 months. It may have been 3 to 6. I just don't know. I remember the first time that I voiced it to a pastor, and that was in Kauai. The pastor actually came in and asked me. He read verses out of Isaiah. I can't even remember now. I suppose if I tried to go back and remember,
but then he went back inside again, thought about this, and then came out and gave you the heave-ho.
No, that's not what happened.
Oh, okay.
No, he listened to me, and as I was, I said, let's just read it for what it says. I'm still laying in the sun. He's got his Bible. And he's standing there. This guy's never laid in the sun day in his life. He's from Minnesota. And of course, Michael's from Minnesota. So we're at a pastor's house who's from Minnesota, who has sold his furniture business and started a church in Kauai. And so he's standing there with his Bible and asking me as he's reading through this. And I said, well, let's just read what it says. And he started reading it. And I said, well, it says this, 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 and this. And he looked at it and he said, oh, my God. And tears started flowing down his face. And he said, he was the one that made the comment. He said, if this is true, that means that everybody is redeemed. Now, that came out of his mouth, not mine. By then, I'm crying because here I'm at this, as you said, watershed moment in my life. And this is the first pastor that I've opened up and talked to about this. And he is the one I'm thinking this is like the divine moment, that because I didn't approach him with it. He approached me.
You thought it was a divine moment for him.
Yes, and for myself.
Okay.
Because this was the affirmation. Go ahead, you can. People are going to understand this. Then he did go back inside, but then he came back outside, and believe me, the tears had stopped. And then all the concerns started coming out, and I said, "Oh, I understand." And he kind of did to me what I had done to Michael. He forbade me to mention it while I was there at his church.
So when he went inside, he went and rang someone up, I reckon.
He must have called the elders or somebody, I don't know, or his own conscience. I just don't know what happened. And then very night, I went back to the church to teach, and I read through some verses in Isaiah, and the verse said that he was the redeemer of the whole world, and I simply read the verse. I wasn't teaching on that. It was just that was in the verse. And when we got home, I was called up to be confronted with, you did exactly what I told you not to do. And his wife was standing there agreeing with him that I had done this. And all I had done is read a verse that contained that in it. But they were adamant that I had broken my promise to him that I would not preach on it. So then we were invited to leave the house. And by then it was close to midnight then.
So Mike's now sitting in your house.
Mm-hmm.
How long since that Hawaii trip?
Oh, goodness. Michael, what year was it we were in Hawaii?
That would have been
96?
No, 94. 93, 92. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
90.
It was early 90s.
Yeah, early 90s, because I left the ministry in 1990.
Michael left the ministry February of 94. He was still around a couple of years after that, a year to 2 years after that.
Hey, how would you describe this friend of yours called Michael? How would you describe him?
Last night we were sitting outside, and I decided just to say something that something was, you know, needed to be moved or something. I don't even remember now what it was. And Michael just jumped up to do it immediately. And I got really tickled. And I told him, I said, you know, Michael, I said, if there's any word that describes you, it is accommodating.
So do me a favor. Can you turn the camera around? You and I will keep talking, but can you turn the camera around so I can see Michael's face?
Of course.
So there it is. So in your opinion, what would Michael's worst attribute? No, leave it there.
This is not helping the people listening to know that you are watching Michael.
Oh, no.
What are you doing?
You're going to repeat the questions after me. So if there was one thing that you considered Michael was really good at, what would that be?
If I were to consider one thing that Michael is really good at, what would that be?
Yep.
That is, honestly, it's very difficult to answer. I mean, I told him last night, if there is a picture in the dictionary next to the word accommodating, it would be his picture.
If there is anything that he would be bad at, what would that be?
If there's anything that Michael is bad at.
Yeah, if there was anything in your ministry you would not turn over to Michael, what would it be?
Oh, at the time, if there was anything in the ministry I would not turn over to Michael at the time, 20 years ago, getting up in front of people and saying anything.
Why, would he tell the truth?
No, he would come off of the hinges, off the tracks. And I mean, just, it was quite amazing. Now, the thing of it is, you have to understand that Michael is now the president of one part of his organization. All he does is fly into different cities and do meetings with different groups of people, and he's fantastic at it.
So what changed for Michael in the meantime?
Well, he got involved with a grassroots organization just to try to help make people's lives better in this country. The amazing thing about Michael is he's always had a great passion for the gospel and has never lost that over these years. But he found a real purpose in life. Michael was just growing in his understanding of himself and becoming confident in who he was, and he became confident being up in front of people, and it served him very well in the job that he grew into. I mean, he started at the ground floor in this and wound up the president of the organization. In fact, that's why he's here in Houston. One of their offices opened here in Houston, and he's here two or three times a year when we didn't get to see each other for years at a time, and now that's all changed, and Michael comes into Houston, spends several days at his office and with his staff down here, and then schedules the weekend to stay over here, and that's what we did this time.
Okay, can we have a break and come back and talk to Mike?
Yes.
Okay, Mike.
When you're feeling down or you got the case of the blues, why don't you listen to the Gospel Revolution?
Now, I wanted to mention again today Bob Hines' new book, Redemption, A Declaration for All, Not a Choice for a Few. 600 of you, get that, 600 of you downloaded the e-book, and that is wonderful. But if you're like me, then you have friends out there who are still trapped on the treadmill and you long to see them set free. Had lunch the other day with Steve Esri, who told me about a friend of his who would not listen to a word that Steve said because he knew that he wanted to talk to him about the concept of the redemption of the world. Turns out that Steve gave him one of the books and said, look, all I'm asking you to do, I think it was a draft copy, all I'm asking you to do is tell me how well or badly it's written. If you can just read the first, say, three chapters and just give me some feedback, I'd appreciate that. After reading one chapter, the guy rings Steve with tears saying, you know, maybe this is true. I'm not telling you I agree with it. I'm just saying that this has really struck a chord in me. Well, good news for those of you who feel the same way about your friends. Bob Hines' new book, Redemption, A Declaration for All, Not a Choice for a Few, is now available in hard copy. It looks good, reads well, and is purpose-built for chapter chumps and verse victims. You know those dogma dictocrats who say, I won't believe it if you don't show me the verse. This is for them. 292 pages, free shipping to the door. This book is chock-a-block full of highly annotated, fully referenced material, originally designed for ministers of religion and seminary professors, and it is still one of the easiest 300 pages I've ever read. Bob Hines does not make a statement without fully explaining it from Bible sources. And now a printed edition with wide margins for all you folks who like to make the notes. This book has a real value of, I don't know, maybe 5 to 6 times its cover price of $24.95 shipped to your door. If you've ever bought books for a Bible college course or a divinity degree, you know exactly what I'm talking about. TrueGospel.net, TrueGospel.net, Bob Hines' new book, Redemption, A Declaration for All, Not a Choice for a Few, www.TrueGospel.net. Go there, order it today. Redemption, A Declaration for All, Not a Choice for a Few.
Gospel Revolution.
Mr. Michael Blanch, we have so much been looking forward to talking with you, mate.
Hey, good morning.
How are you in Houston today?
I'm good. Good.
Welcome to the Gospel Revolution.
Thank you.
Like, you need welcoming.
So we got the Deep South accent from Michael Williams, Tennessee. We got the Aussie, and I get the Minnesota boy. Super duper.
Oh, you had the Minnesota boy. We'll fix that real fast.
Yeah, sure as heck fire. You know, I got to tell you, I was listening to Michael telling the story about me continuing to pester him around the gospel of peace. And I remember where we had the breakthrough. It was actually, I had to change my strategy because Michael was getting a little annoyed with me pestering. And do you guys remember the 1970s sitcom All in the Family with Archie Bunker,
yeah,
kind of surly, and Edith Archie, you know, that gal? You remember that?
You're good.
And the trick was she would try to create the best conditions possible in order to get Archie to be compliant. So she would get his favorite chair fluffed up, his favorite TV show, get a good meal, get him relaxed, and then would, you know, drop some news on him. And I did change my strategy, and the breakthrough, Michael, was at a poolside, because he does like his pools. He likes his sun in Michigan. And that's where I had the breakthrough. He was relaxed. He was tanning. He was happy. And but I remember the verse, and I even wrote it down. It was, I heard Michael night after night preaching from Romans 1:16, and he would say, "I'm not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God unto salvation to those who believe, to the Jew first and then also the Gentile, for in it is righteousness revealed." I said, "Michael, this is us believing doesn't make us righteous. We're supposed to believe that we are righteous. The gospel is good news. It's already happened. Me believing it doesn't make it happen, because then what, my believing makes it news?" And it was a journey. It's a journey, but this gospel of peace and knowing that the whole world was redeemed through Christ is pretty awesome. Pretty awesome.
Where did you meet Mike?
You know, I think Michael came to my church, Country Bible in Minnesota, back in 1989.
So this is Michael Blanch, and your home church was called what?
Country Bible. A church alive is worth the drive. It's true. That's what they said.
I am lost for words, mate. Was he established? Was he a known quantity back then?
Oh, yeah. I would say that was the heyday of the Word of Faith movement, and that's when Michael was traveling around in his 15-foot ministry bus. That's when his main ministry was, God healed me from homosexuality and all that silliness. So,
wasn't silliness to me. Go on. You've just insulted me. What else would you like to do?
I don't mean to hurt your feelings, Bears.
Well, just give me 3 or 4 minutes. I'll get over it. Can you sing a song in the meantime?
Oh, I suppose I probably could, couldn't I? You know, it depends on which one. You know, of course, without my guitar, it's a little tougher.
You sing with a guitar, do you?
Yeah, that's what I did with Michael. Yeah. Yeah, when I was on the road with him.
Oh, you shouldn't have said that. Okay, sing me a song. Come on. We got 600,000 people out there who want to hear this.
Well, let's see. Let me think of a song here. We were in Bastrop. Since we're in Texas, we were in a church called in Bastrop, Texas, and this guy heard the gospel, and he wrote a song. And let's see. How did it go? Oh, in last night I passed a wino who was passed out on the curb. His drunken, dreamless slumber I did not dare disturb. His thoughts concerning bathtubs was clear and evident. And as I passed him by, I heard him as I went. And he said, please look at me the way that Jesus looks at me. You formed your first impression, there's no doubt. Try to look at me the way that Jesus looks at me. He sees me as I really am, loves me inside out. The preacher was self-righteous and so thankful to be white. His arrogance succeeded only by his appetite. I wondered how he could walk with his head up there that way. But as I passed him by, I thought I heard him say, and he said, please look at me the way that Jesus looks at me. You formed your first impression, there's no doubt. And it goes on and on. But it really is interesting that in that song, Barris was, it was really about self-righteousness. And we know when you're standing up looking down at people, I'm better than you, you know, that's self-righteous. But the other end of the spectrum is I don't measure up. And that's self-righteous too.
Wow.
All that guilt and shame.
What did self-righteousness do for you before you encountered the gospel of grace and peace, before this whole thing impacted you?
Oh, God, Barris.
How were you self-righteous?
It was really, really tough. You know, I think Michael shared earlier that my father's health was going south. And, you know, when we have bad things that happen in our lives, you know, your car breaks down. Someone you love gets sick, and that's tough as it is. But in self-righteous thinking, and in that church world, when something bad happened in my life, I was asking myself, what did I do that caused that? You know, because the church taught me that you're under God's umbrella of protection, but if you screw up, you're going to walk off from God's umbrella of protection, and bad things are going to happen. So it was.
But couldn't you say it was Dad's fault? This happened to him? You couldn't remove yourself from that equation?
No. I truly believe that the reason my dad got ill was because, you know, something I did, you know? And yeah, it was mental illness, you know, spiritual abuse.
What brings upon you that mental illness?
Well, yeah, I mean, trying to become something you already are is pretty destabilizing, you know.
Explain that for people who are hearing this for the first time.
Well, God, not to get too teachy, but since we are on the Gospel Revolution Hour, I think about the devil, right? And I'd sit in church and they go, "Oh, the Satan's coming to tempt you," and I was taught that was drugs, sex, and rock and roll. And
well, it's drugs and rock and roll, at least, surely.
Yeah, of course, absolutely. And but when you think about it, and I think Michael's taught on this, that he was tempting. He tempts us to become something we already are. You look back in the garden with Adam, and then you look at Jesus, you know, in the wilderness, and what was it? God said, "I created Adam in my image, according to my likeness, a perfect living soul." And God said, "Whatever you do, don't eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, because in that day you shall surely die." And the devil comes along and says, "Hey, if you eat of that tree, you'll become like God." He already was like God, but he partook in self-righteous thinking the knowledge of good and evil. Surely if I do good, I'm qualified with God. Surely if I fail, I'm disqualified. And the moment you enter into that belief system, you become destabilized and mentally ill.
How does our belief system predicate the way we will think?
That's a good question, Barris. I don't know if I really have the answer to that. For some reason, I suppose, you know, we're called to renew our minds daily, but we seem kind of hardwired to slip and engage in self-righteous thinking. Like I said, I think for me, I always recognize that if I believed I'm climbing this ladder and each rung represents something different I got to do to get closer to God. And then I'm up the ladder looking down at you going, "Oh, you haven't measured up." And I always knew that was self-righteousness. But then I'd fall off the ladder and I'd start feeling sorry for myself going, "Oh gosh, I screwed up. Now I don't feel qualified with God." And but I never recognized that as self-righteousness, but it was.
Oh, that's
just on the other end. God created us as human beings, not human doings. What you do doesn't make you who you are. Who you are is why we do good things. You know, and there's plenty of religions out there that are good at modifying behavior, and the gospel revolution is way more powerful. And I just say, no, you're a human being. You're not a human doing. You're one with God. You know what? If someone came to me full of fear and unbelief, I truly believe that they're already one with God. So I would just love them and treat them as one.
How do you love somebody?
To me, loving is viewing someone as equal to me. I was in the pretty hardcore version of Christianity, and I sort of jumped out of the fire into the frying pan into the fire because after I left Michael, I started some work in the political world, and I got friends across the political spectrum. There's a lot of division in politics, as you may know. And so here's how the gospel really does impact my real life in a daily basis is I'm able to understand that we're all very passionate, but I'll never let my passion for the issues I care about outpace my compassion for everyone that's affected by those issues. And I think the gospel has created a space in my heart to love my neighbor, even if I disagree with them. And, you know, there's so much dehumanizing going on. I've seen my friends on the left dehumanize people on the right. I've seen my friends on the right dehumanize their opposition on the left. And don't get me wrong, I think we all have our opinions. I know I got mine, and I love being right. But I came to the point with whatever you believe, does it foster respect? Does it foster love towards yourself and others? And I think love is respecting others. And the only way I can have true respect towards others is to believe that we're all one. There's so many things that divide us. I mentioned politics is one, but race, class, culture, there's so many things that divide us. And it's only been within the gospel, believing that we're all one, that I find a space to love my neighbor. I see them as me. And if I hurt them, I'm hurting myself.
In that space, what can you achieve?
Oh, my God. In that space, you actually have the ability to hear others and understand others, even if you disagree with them, because there's an honest, genuine space of love and respect. I'm able to have a conversation with someone that I disagree big time with, but I still believe they're my brother. They're my sister. You know, we're one. That creates a space for me to be able to hear them. Then they're able to hear me, and all of a sudden, we're actually having a conversation. And we may not agree on everything, but it's this environment of love and respect, and it just feels good. You don't walk away dehumanizing your brother.
If that's true, what you're saying, why do we have such polarity in modern culture?
Oh, we need to spread the gospel. It's not being heard enough. I mean, I don't know. Human nature somehow, for some reason, gravitates towards self-righteous thinking. And as you know, there are plenty of churches out there right now where you go in there and they're teaching you to try to become something you already are. We're righteous. You go in there and they say, you got to do this, 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 and this to be right with God. And I think people get so busy. I mean, when I was in the church, Barris, I remember trying so hard to get right with God all the time. I didn't have the energy to look at my brother or my sister and help them out because I was so busy trying to get right with God, you know. And God, I swear, that was my experience. And now that I know that I'm one with God, I can now take the blinders off and look at my brother and sister going, you're one with God too. But I, you know, why the world is so divided, or a country, I think it's we are what we eat. We are what we listen to. I think there's a lot of divisive commentary on the news channels, in the churches, that you know, create a lot of confusion for good people. And like I said, I got a lot of dear friends, and they're good people. But they're exhausted, they're sad, they're worried about the world, they don't have any hope. Oh my God, it's all going to hell in a handbasket. You know, I said, turn the TV off. Turn the TV off and put Michael Williams tapes in. You know.
Why didn't you stay with Mike? Why didn't you keep preaching the gospel of grace and peace?
You know, that's a great question. It was, I was young, of course. I wanted to get out on my own. I left Michael's, I was 23 at the time. But I actually did have a little bit of a positive existential crisis. It came to the point where I'm like, gosh, Michael, if everyone's one, why should I be going from church to convince people who they are? And I thought, well, I believe the whole world's one, so I'm just going to go out and do something else. So actually, two reasons. One is I was young and I wanted to kind of grow my own wings and get out from the shadow of this giant tree of a man, Mike Williams. The other was a little bit of knowing that the whole world's one. Why should I have to go around and tell them that? You know, now I actually do believe people need to know that instead of going out and convincing them you got to believe to be made righteous, I think people need to know that, yeah, no, you're right with God. And, you know, there was a tip, the biggest tipping point, and this is still true to my life right now. If whatever I believe, if what is and is to come and what was is all based on me having things figured out, I thought, God, we're screwed, you know? But I'm convinced that what I believe and understand doesn't change God. But my belief system of thinking impacts how I think God views me, how I view myself, and how I view others. And I came to a place where I believe that we're all one with God, you know? So
I think I heard you say that what you believe does not impact God or change God or in any way alter the truth. What you believe impacts you, changes you, ameliorates what you think about you, and in you I include others like you.
That's exactly right, Barris. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Not a bad translation for an Aussie.
Yeah, well, you know, some of us get to secondary education. We got to go overseas for tertiary education, of course. But don't you laugh, mate. Don't you laugh. When I'm 30 years old, I go home. I'm away from home all this time. I went home, and guess the first thing I found under the house was my old slate. I used to use a slate and a slate pen. Do you know what a slate is? No, you don't. I can see.
It sounds really old, I think. Is it
Yeah, it would be now. I reckon if I had it, it'd be worth a few hundred dollars. It was it was a piece of stone, yeah. Chiseled out of a cliff, out of a slate mine.
Okay.
And it was surrounded by timber, by pine, and you wrote on it with another piece of slate. In other words, it was a rock writing on another rock. I'm telling you, when I say I was raised in the Stone Age, I'm telling you, I'm not making this crap up. You know what I'm saying?
That makes like the chalkboard, the iPad of its day.
Oh,
right.
And very advanced at that.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So,
that's great.
So you're on the board of the Gospel Revolution.
That's right.
Well, I don't have this exalted position, so I have to defer to you. What are we all about?
Well, we're all about knowing that we're all one through Jesus. The whole world is one. I think that's the shortest answer. It really is. It's about oneness. It's about love. It's about respect. It's about equality.
Okay. How do we get
there? It's about freedom. What's that?
What is the board's concept on how we get there?
Well, you know, I think there is a lot of indoctrination out there in the world. There's a lot of unteaching that needs to happen. And so I was just talking to Michael about the power of his ministry. And, you know, and I know that it's had some bumps in the road. I was with Michael in the old days when he would fill churches with 5,000 people. And here we are now. And I watched him throughout the years struggle financially, and every day he gets a phone call, someone saying, wow, the gospel changed my life. I no longer feel guilt and shame. I remember one time I was in a meeting where a woman came up to Michael and said, I was indoctrinated by my church. I asked my pastor, what happens when I screw up? Does God get mad? And he said, well, think of it this way. God gave you a box. And every time you screw up, God drops a rock in that box. And the box will hold for a while, but eventually, you screw up too many times, all hell will break loose. And that woman, full of tears, said, you know, I threw that box away today. I think about that. I remember another person that came to us and had what appeared to be scars and was taking many times a day scalding hot showers and baths, preparing herself for hell. You know, and again, freed from guilt and shame. So I think there's a lot of fear and a lot of guilt and a lot of shame still out there. A lot of law, grace mixed with law. There's a lot of people that have not been told that the whole world's been redeemed. We got to get the word out. Let people know you are redeemed and heal those broken hearts. I mean, it's about freeing people, you know, emotionally and spiritually. And then when those shackles come off, boom.
Who is our target market?
You know, That's a great – who's the target market for the – I would say everyone, of course. I would think the people that need to hear it the most are probably people trapped in the churches. But I've seen a lot of my friends that aren't self-identified Christians, people that actually haven't even really lived in a church that preached guilt and shame, that are attracted to Michael's message. Basically, they see in me this ability to operate day-to-day in a political world where I can – love my neighbor and love my opposition. And I know in my world, people are like, how do you do that? And that's an opening to share this concept that we're all one. And so I think there's got to be a target market of people out there. It's not necessarily just people that are steeped in guilt and shame. That's a target market. But I think it's for people that are really, their heart's desire is to connect to humanity. And I think the gospel really fosters that.
Who do we seem to have the greatest effect upon?
I think it's people that are trapped in the law, trapped in religion, trapped in this belief that they can earn God's approval or earn his wrath. I think that's the biggest impact is that the gospel can have is those people that are, they're righteous, they're perfect in God's eyes, they just don't know it. So they're unable to experience love and peace and joy. Like Michael said earlier on this podcast, those people that were told the reason you're not being healed is because of something you did. It's a lie. I really think those are the people that are the most impacted by this message.
In the board's opinion, what should we be doing to reach them?
Well, I think it's each one teach one, to be corny, but I think we have, first of all, we need resources. I think we do need to raise more money so we can spread the word. I mean, there's just no doubt. We live in a real world where it takes resources to get this message out to the world. And so that's where the rubber hits the road. And then I think there's a lot of people that are touched by this word and this gospel, and they got circles of influences where they're going to tell their friend and their family members. And then there's this exponential tipping point that I believe is going to happen here soon. But it's about resources. It's about resources.
What is it about your expertise that puts you on our board?
I have 20 years experience working with nonprofits coast to coast on a variety of issues, specifically designed around raising funds through community organizing. And what's good about that is I've been with organizations where they get a big fat grant, and that's nice, but there's strings attached to it. And you can talk about this, but you can't talk about that. It's not unlike that church that Michael is at going, yep, we'll pay you to come in, but don't talk about the redemption of the world or you're 86th. And so these nonprofits I worked with said, you need to be able to control your own destiny, and you can't be tied just to one funder. And so there's strength in numbers. And when everyone chips in a little bit, it adds up to a lot. So my expertise has been in helping organizations do a lot of small donor fundraising, where instead of one big grant, like in Minnesota, I had a group, and they have 200,000 members, and they all give. Not a lot, but some people give $5 a month. Some people give $36 a month, but that adds up to millions. And not any one of them couldn't write that check, but together they can. And then they're able to further a cause and a message that matters to them. And I think that's what we can do with the ministry here. But you got to ask people, you know, that's the first rule of raising funds for anything that matters. Number one, winning concrete improvements in people's lives.
Say that so again. Winning concrete.
Winning concrete improvements in people's lives. That's number one. When you think about philanthropy, what's the active word? Filio, love of people. The end in mind is that you want to make a difference. And so that's the first thing. So you got to be mission focused and know that you're making a difference. If you're not, why would you ask for help and support? Number two, it's empowering large numbers of people. And that's that whole idea of strength in numbers and pulling them together in their resources. Number three, you got to ask. There's lots of people that would love to give, but I've seen organizations going, oh, we have no support. I go, have you asked? Well, no, I guess not. You got to ask. And then you also got to give them a goal. They don't know if you're asking for a dime or if you're asking for $1 million. So you got to give them a target. You know, amounts are open, you know, challenging folks to help out with, you know, $36 a month. And if they say they can't do that, that's cool. That's why we leave the amounts open so everyone can get involved and make a difference. So scale it back and find something that works for you. Then, okay, I'll do $6 a month. And then keep them up to speed on the impact of that. You know, I think that's the other thing is letting them know, sharing these stories. The reason I give to Michael's ministry is I've seen the impact of the gospel on my life and on the woman with the box. My God, that's amazing. You know, throwing her box away. you know, God's not dropping rocks on me anymore. You want to be able to share those victories and how hearts are being changed. And so I would also say more testimonials where you get people talking about the impact, not just spiritually, but how they're able to better relate to their family, their friends, and even people that they have differences with, because we can all relate to that.
Now, I'm just going to ride the shirt tails of that last comment there, Michael. I think that's a fantastic idea, testimonials. Family, I know that there's a lot of you, and this gospel of grace and peace has made such a huge difference in your life. I'm going to give you a phone number, and I'd like you to call it. If this gospel has done anything for you, if this gospel has given you peace, if this gospel has removed guilt and shame, if this gospel has just made your family life easier, heck, it did mine, I want you to call this number. Are you ready? 234-564-0971. That is area code 234-564-0971. Call that number. All you need to do is say, hey, listen, this is Joe Blow from Calgary, and I first heard Mike about 10 years ago, and our whole family is different now, or whatever you want, whatever the truth is for you. And I know that some of the changes have been good, and I know that some of them haven't been easy, but would you ring that number? We would just love to hear back from some of you saying, hey, thank you so much. See, Mike's paid the price. And we would just love to know that it was worth it. We know it is, but we'd like to hear the stories. Would you call us now? Area code 234-564-0971. Thanks so much. Now, Michael, talking about giving, we used to give a lot more in the old days, didn't we?
You know what's funny, Barris? In the church world, we used to give way more all the time. They'd pass the plate. You'd give on Wednesdays. You'd give on Sundays. You tithe. As a board member, my job is, if Michael is going to need resources to spread the message, to make sure that he's mission focused, and which he is. You know, he's got a clear message. He's not backsliding back into law. He could go back to the old days and mix a little law with grace and make money. He could. But that is a big point, that he can be pure to this message. You're right. He could mix law and grace and go back to his old way of being and make lots of money, but it wouldn't make a difference in people's lives. We want to win concrete improvements in people's lives, and the real gospel does that.
What is the biggest difference in your life that this gospel of grace and peace has brought to you?
Oh, the biggest impact is I have a genuine place in my heart that can respect people I don't agree with.
On Monday morning when you're driving to work and somebody gives you the bird and gives you a hard time, how does that translate into Monday morning?
To be honest, I'm just thinking, oh, they need a hug. I have a kind of a weird world view, but I'm like, oh, you know, they're stressed out, you know, they're having a bad day, you know, and that's just normal. We're one, and from that space, I can actually find compassion towards almost anyone, even the pedophile. They're going to go to jail, but they're still a part of God's creation. I've got to keep love and compassion in my heart, and the gospel provides that for me.
If you had never heard of Mike Williams or the gospel of grace and peace, where would you be now?
Oh, Lord. You know, I don't think I'd be here. I think the reality is I just didn't feel that I measured up. As a little kid, I always wanted to make a difference to my community.
Hang on, you're 7 or 8 years old and you're thinking in these mature terms already?
I was. Wow. At a very young age.
Wow.
And of course, you know, I was also, grew up in Lutheran Bible school, you know, in kindergarten. So it started there too. But the saddest thing was thinking that I'm disqualified with God. Therefore, who am I to make a difference in anyone else's life if I'm disappointing God? And, you know, I wanted to make a difference and I want to, but before I met Mike Williams and heard the gospel, I truly believed I was disqualified with God. I remember writing letters to God going, I'm so sorry I let you down again. I'm so sorry. I'm trying my best. Guilt and shame was an everyday emotion. It was short-circuiting my ability to be a benefit to my family and my friends. So had I not heard Michael and the gospel, I think there would have been a good chance that I might have, I can't believe I'm saying this, but removed myself from this planet because I was tired of disappointing God. I remember there was a moment where I was going to say, God, forgive me all my sins. Now I'm going to end my life. Therefore, I don't screw up and burn in hell. There was a little bit of that at one time. It's embarrassing to say, but that was a thought that I had in my early years.
So you took it very seriously, your upbringing.
Oh, yeah, I did.
Do you listen to our podcast?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I always enjoy it.
Mike Blanche, sometime traveling companion of Michael Williams, lobbyist for various groups. If any of our people want to get in touch with you, how would they do it?
They can connect through me through Friends with Mike Williams on Facebook, and they can message me right there, Michael Blanche.
The celebrated Michael Blanche. Michael, Michael Blanche, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a real bit of fun, and it's been great to hear from a different angle, from a different a place and a different person. Is there any last messages for our people you'd like to share, mate?
The biggest thing I would want to say to our listeners of Mike Williams, there's a real-life application to this gospel. Without a doubt, for those that are first hearing this, that are sitting in guilt and shame and trying to come out of religion, you're going to feel incredible peace and joy. I know for myself, to the same degree that I felt shame and guilt, I now feel peace and joy. And the juxtaposition of the two is amazing. It really is. It's you don't enjoy the light until you've been in darkness. But the real life application is it can condition your heart and your mind to have an edge in this life, at work, in your career, with your partner, with your family, because it is a gospel that fosters respect and a sense of connectedness that you can't find in religion. And my mantra in life is we're all very passionate, whether it be our careers, our belief systems, our politics, our families, but never let your passion for whatever outpace your compassion for your community and people you love. And the gospel creates a space of compassion, and that's what I'd like to leave with listeners. Compassion and purpose. You know, Barris, I got to say, as a board member of this great message of the gospel, I actually really believe there is a tipping point that's happening. And over the next 4 to 6 months, I'm expecting exponential growth within the ministry. Part of it is, as a board member, we're looking at ways to really focus in on this incredible base of support that we have and how to really put together a plan to maximize our resources to spread this message. So we're going to be a lot more deliberate and thoughtful on that front, and not only in terms of raising the resource to spread this message, but also on how to help our base spread this word in a more powerful way. So look forward to it. I think in the next 4 to 6 months, we're going to see some good stuff and some good growth. Wherever you are in life, whatever belief system you're hanging on to right now, if you've ever wondered if there's something more out there, there really is. If life seems to be crumbling around you and you wonder if there's a light at the end of that tunnel, is there hope? I can assure you there really is. Whatever culture, whatever background you're coming from, and you have wondered, is there more to the world than my narrow perspective where I can feel connected in a bigger way? That answer is yes. There's a gospel of peace, a gospel of grace. There is power out there that will foster unbelievable stability, unbelievable love and respect towards yourself and others, and it is quite revolutionary.
And so it is that we must leave you, folks. We love you, one and all, and we especially thank those who, by their financial support, ensure that this weekly podcast always goes out on time. If you'd like to join them in increasing our coverage of this gospel of grace and peace, call our office at area code 321-220-4373 and speak to Jeffrey. If you would like to leave a message for the show, simply telephone us at 234-564-0971. Our web address is www.gospelrevolution.com, and we are always up for a Facebook chat at Friends of Mike Williams and the Gospel Revolution. Remember, no Christians were harmed in the making of this program, and thanks to Marcel Roos in the Netherlands, all the gospel all the time is being broadcast 24/7 at gospelrevolution.radiostream123.com. And so, it is good night from myself, Barris Bartlett, from the Gospel Revolution Studios in Nashville, Tennessee, and from Michael Blanche in Houston.
Good night, folks.
And from Michael Williams, the founder and president of the Gospel Revolution.
I want Michael to sing the very first Gospel Revolution song for you.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he learned to play the guitar while he was traveling with me. And he started writing the very first songs of the Gospel Revolution. So He's rehearsing at the moment, but we can go ahead and do my closing, and then we can get some more stuff in there.
And so it is good night from myself, Barris Bartlett, from the Gospel Revolution Studios in Nashville, Tennessee, and...
And it's good evening from Michael Williams right here in beautiful Houston, Texas. I still don't know why everybody doesn't live here.
So remember to join us same time again next week, same channel, where
it's got to be done
even better.
Are you telling me you travel with this guy? I mean, this guy, and that,
I mean, we did travel with this guy, and yeah, one of the things that I wanted to share about the time that Michael and I traveled together, and I guess it was the better part of 4 years, I think, isn't that right, Michael? A better part of 4 years, maybe more. And during that time, Michael actually started trying to learn how to play the guitar. Now he is actually a very accomplished guitarist, and he started writing the very first songs of the Gospel Revolution. And I am sure that no one has heard this. I remember Michael singing this song to me the very first time. I remember him sitting over on his bed, jotting notes and strumming chords and jotting notes and strumming chords and driving me up the wall, you know, from because there's, I mean, an artist is an artist, and their end result is always really wonderful. The process, though, it's like they say, you don't want to be where the sausage is made. And but with us traveling in the capacity that we did, we were always in close proximity to each other. So I heard Michael learn how to play the guitar, and I heard Michael learn how to write songs. You know, we're talking about the history of the Gospel Revolution today, and we talk about it quite often now, but I want Michael to sing the very first Gospel Revolution song. We've got a lot of people writing books now. You got to understand, this song was written when nobody had written a book, nobody had written a song, nobody had strummed a chord about this at all. And so I want you to hear this. It really is. It touches my heart every time, for sure. I want to see how you like it. Love it.
I want you to know that I find no fault in you, for behold, I've made all things new. Comfort ye my people, tell them the war is won, that I've made them righteous through the blood of my own Son. What they need to know is simply a gospel revelation that God has made them one. What they need to know is simply a righteous revelation that God has made them one through the blood of Jesus. That God has called them sons through the blood of Jesus. In Him we overcome. God's no longer angry. His wrath's been satisfied. It was for this purpose Jesus Christ bled and died. Jesus became sin for the entire human race. Oh, He made us righteous by His amazing grace. What we need to know is simply a gospel revelation that God has made them one. What they need to know is simply a righteous revelation that God has made them one through the blood of Jesus. That God has called them sons through the blood of Jesus. In Him we overcome.
And that's the song.
Gospel Revolution.